Welcome back to Downrange Radio, the audio podcast incarnation of Downrange Television, www.downrange.tv, and our exclusive coverage of the landmark Supreme Court decision reaffirming the Second Amendment as an individual right to keep and bear arms. I'm your host, Michael Bain, also the host of Shooting Gallery every Wednesday night on the Outdoor Channel. And what we've been doing today, this is the day after the landmark decisions come down, and we've been talking to Second Amendment attorneys, Second Amendment scholars, to get a sense of what we've won, what is our victory, and at the same time, where we're going to need to go. Now, coming up next is David Hardy. David Hardy, of course, if you're on the internet, you know him from his blog of Arms and the Law. He is one of the foremost Second Amendment attorneys out there. He's, of course, worked in the United States Solicitor General's office, numerous awards, and been very thoughtful in his contributions over the years to the Second Amendment fight. He is also the creator and producer of In Search of the Second Amendment, probably the best documentary on what the Second Amendment is, what it means, and very much his conclusions of that in that documentary have now been ratified by the Supreme Court in a decision written by Justice Antonin Scalia. So we wanted to spend some time with David, talk a little bit about what victory we've won and where we have to go. Here's David Hardy. Dave, let's do this. We know we had a great victory yesterday. Could you just sketch out for me what it is we won?
Okay. Well, in the Heller case, Justice Scalia, writing for the five-person majority, essentially said that a federal ban on handguns is unconstitutional. He didn't go any farther than that. I predicted would be a very narrow decision, and it was. But he did go into massive detail on the history of the Second Amendment, its underpinnings in the British concept of an individual right, and he linked it in what I think is a critical piece of reasoning. He linked the Second Amendment not just to the militia, but to individual self-defense, saying that there was a right of self-defense, the framers knew of it, and that the Second Amendment was largely written with that in mind. That's a major turn. It may seem obvious to us, but the question is, with the Second Amendment, are we just talking about, let's say, militia political purposes, that is, the ability to overthrow a tyrannical government, or are we talking about something more extensive? And in his view, it's something more extensive. Yes, it includes that, but it also includes the right to defend yourself against a criminal. So I think that's a critical component of his decision. I think it was a breakthrough decision, and I notice legal scholars are already hailing it, not only for its Second Amendment implications, but also for a great return to originalism, to the theory that you interpret the Constitution by how it was understood when it was being put together. And you don't bring in modern components. The question is what did the framers mean to do? Because Justice Scalia expressly goes with a variant of that, which is, what did the American people in 1789, 1791, think they were getting when they voted to ratify this through conventions or state legislatures? The important thing isn't so much what James Madison thought he was doing. To a greater extent, it would be what the first Congress thought it was doing, but to the greatest extent would be, what did Americans in general think they were getting here? And Scalia's answer is an individual right to keep and bear arms for purposes of self-defense.
You know, for a lot of us, this has been very much a lesson in how high justices think. I know that as a Second Amendment activist myself, over the years, one of the questions that I've had to answer again and again and again and again is like, well, these things were written in the 1700s, and how can you stand before us and say they apply now in the 20th century, in the 21st century? And essentially, Justice Scalia has explained that in pretty much easy-to-understand terms of exactly how what happened in the creation of this nation carries forward into current thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's been a topic of debate among legal scholars. There are originalism, and then there are those who say nonsense. We can never know what people thought back in 1789. And then there are, there was this theory of the living constitution somehow mysteriously changes. I think Professor Volokh took that one apart very nicely. He pointed out that if you look at, did it change in the eyes of the Congress? No, they've six times from 1866 to present declared in legislation the Second Amendment is an individual right. Did it change in the eyes of the states? No. Every state constitutional amendment in the last 100 years dealing with arms has been to make the guarantee more individual. Did it change in the eyes of the public? No. 75% of Americans think they have an individual right to keep and bear arms. So if the Constitution were somehow to change in minds, it didn't do so in Congress, it didn't do so in the states, and it didn't do so among the people. So where is your evolving Constitution here? If anything, it suggests it evolves into even more of an individual right. And the only way to get around that is to say the important thing is that it evolved in the minds of judges or law professors. And if there were such a thing as a living constitution, that's surely the least ethical, shall we say, way of trying to judge it. It's interesting that the dissent even hints at that when Justice Stevens says, the expectations of judges over the last, 50 years have been that it's not an individual right. Okay, so what?
So what? Yes. Let's talk a little bit about that concept of self-defense. I know that when we look at what we think of as constitutional rights, and correct me if I'm wrong here, because, again, I'm not an attorney, and as a joke goes, I don't even play one on television, but... for example, privacy, which is something that's been discussed extensively, say, over the last 5 years, where I believe the Supreme Court has talked a little bit about on those issues, and people were critical, saying, well, there's the word privacy, right of privacy certainly doesn't appear in the Constitution anywhere, but now that's kind of an accepted that there is some sort of right of privacy. Is that what's happening here with self-defense, now that Antonin Scalia has written it into the opinion, that the right of self-defense now becomes much more of a real right, a protectable right?
I think it may have that effect. It'll take a while to trickle down, but I think it does have that effect that we're talking about as they call them, a non-enumerated right, a right that you can't just pick up the Bill of Rights and read it in there. And surely, if it's there and it's linked to an express right, the right to keep and bear arms, I think, yes, self-defense has to be considered a much stronger situation now than it would have been before yesterday.
I think this is important. You know, when we look at our sister country, we look at the country we came from, England, or we look at the soft European socialism states, in those states, I believe that... The violence, the concept of violence is exclusive province of the state. That is, there is no express right of self-defense in England. If you fight back against a mugger, you basically are as guilty as the mugger, because violence is the right of the state. It has no individual expression. So it seems to me that the Supreme Court pretty much took that off the table for America yesterday.
Yeah, I believe they did. The British experience and all of that, it's too complex for me to understand, but I think in theory they still have self-defense, but in practice it's treated so narrowly that someone gave me an example. If you encounter a burglar in your home and deck him with a 2x4, well, in theory you have the right of self-defense, but in practice there's a good chance you'll be charged, because after all, you could have killed him with that 2x4, and so that's lethal force. Whereas, you just encountered him in the darkness, and he didn't use lethal force against you first. So, in theory, it's still there, but in practice, self-defense is not recommended.
Well, it's good to see that off the table here.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the Miller decision. you know, Miller's one of those things that it's been around now for, you know, forever. You know, it's been quoted by both sides and supporting on both sides. It's been hailed and damned. How did the Miller decision come out finally in this Supreme Court decision?
Scalia, for the majority, mostly writes it off. I mean, he acknowledges it's there, but he points out, look, only one side filed a brief or showed up for oral argument. The government's brief was cursory and the resulting decision ambiguous. So he doesn't particularly value Miller that highly. Just, you know, it's a case, but he doesn't consider it the definitive case. The interesting part is the dissents. Justice Stevens, writing for the anti-gun side, joined by three other justices, claims that he's dealing with Miller very extensively and remaining true to it. And then he really, this is an embarrassing screw-up. I mean, I'm trying to think of an analogy. You know, this may sound trivial, but it's, in a legal sense, it's like taking your computer down because it's not working and being told, well, did you remember to turn on the on-off switch? What he does, Stevens says that in Miller, the court upheld a conviction under the National Firearms Act. No. The first thing you look at when you read an appellate decision is what happened below and what did the court do. Then you'll get down into why did it do it. Well, the Miller case didn't uphold the conviction. It didn't uphold anything. Miller was never convicted. He got his charges dismissed at the very outset, and the government appealed, and the Supreme Court reversed. So he wasn't convicted, and the Supreme Court reversed rather than upholding. Well, that tells me Justice Stevens and his clerks didn't really read the Miller case. They just went through and pulled out some quotations and never worried about what should be your first question on looking at it. And the only thing more embarrassing is three other justices joined in and didn't see that. He's got another whopper there, too. He says that in 1901, President Teddy Roosevelt established the National Guard. Well, wait a minute. How would a president have authority to create a National Guard? Actually, the case he cites, the Perpich case, says in 1901, President Roosevelt called for revitalizing the militia. In 1903, Congress created the National Guard. So he must just have skimmed that decision and, you know, just made a slip of dates and who did it.
What you're saying here is that this morning in Washington, there are some Supreme Court clerks that are being forced to walk a plank.
Yeah. I mean, this is a real... I suspect before it actually goes to the printer for the final printing, there will have to be some changes. Because, I mean, these are embarrassing mistakes.
I live with an attorney, and she's pointed out to me that at a Supreme Court level, clerks and justices certainly are not supposed to make those kind of mistakes.
Oh, no. It's supposed to be absolutely perfect or as close as you can come.
Let's talk a little bit about scrutiny. You know, that's something that prior to the decision had been discussed at great lengths, is what level of scrutiny is applied. And it seemed to me that there were implications for scrutiny in the decision, but Justice Scalia and the majority didn't want to stand up and say, here is what you apply. Am I misreading that?
Yeah. Well, they did rule out one thing, which is when you're assessing whether a regulation of a right is valid, you can do it at three levels. One of them is rational basis, which is almost nothing. I mean, it's... would the legislature have had a rational basis for thinking this was a reasonable regulation? Well, almost all the time you can do that. Scalia's opinion says no, rational basis is out. You can't use rational basis on any expressly stated right in the Bill of Rights. And then there's intermediate scrutiny, which actually, that came out after I went to law school, so I'm not too clear on it. And then there's the highest level, which is strict scrutiny, which is what we'd hope for, which is they really look at the law. Did it have a compelling reason behind it? Will it really address that problem properly? And is it narrowly drafted in the sense that it does the absolute minimum necessary to achieve that end. There's no spillover effects where you're regulating something that wouldn't have had to be regulated to achieve what you were doing. So on that one, if you get to that one, and it's correctly fought out by the legal team, that can be pretty hard to get past. But Scalia doesn't make it clear. He just says that a total prohibition of handguns fails any test, which does at least give us one thing, which is a total prohibition of handguns would fail all the tests, the intermediate tests, too. But beyond that, we don't really have a clue.
One other thing that I know it's been, especially now with the lawsuits filed against Chicago, of course, one thing I guess we need to make clear is this decision applies to one law in one place, and that's the District mm-hmm. of Columbia and their handgun ban. It is not, and again, correct me on constitutional law here, it's not automatically applicable to other municipalities and other states. That's something that has to be, that will have to be litigated.
It's applicable to the federal government, and D.C. is about the one city I can think of that is run by the federal government. Back in the 1830s, the Supreme Court said that the Bill of Rights of the United States applies to the United States government only. Basically, if you want to have a right protected against your own state, put it in your state constitution. That prevailed until 1868. Some people don't realize is some states, for example, had established churches, an official church that your tax money went to up into the 1830s because the First Amendment didn't apply to them. Yeah, they really did. I think one lasted in the 1840s. So
wow, I did not realize that.
Yeah. And 1868, for the first time you get a constitutional amendment that binds the states in some way, the 14th Amendment. And its history is really complicated in the courts. Basically, the court initially tried to sabotage it. Well, it sabotaged it very nicely. Then in the 1960s, it started making a comeback with, it says, no state may deprive any person of due process of law. And in the 20th century, the court started saying certain rights are so important that if you deprive people of them, certain federal U.S. Bill of Rights rights are so critical that if you deprive someone of it, that's deprivation of due process of law, and therefore a state cannot do it. The problem is the court would pick the rights one at a time, and since you didn't have much of an individual right under the Second Amendment, it never got around to the Second Amendment. I think the only ones left are the Second Amendment and the right to be indicted, to demand a grand jury indictment to start a felony case. That's never been applied to the states either. So there's still two rights sitting out there that that the court has never said apply to the states. Just now, Alan Gura, right after the Heller decision, filed a suit in Chicago to challenge the city's ban, and that'll raise exactly that issue. Is it applicable under the 14th Amendment? Can we apply the handgun ban is invalid to a state as well as to the feds? So we may have an answer on that in a few years.
That, of course, is the hardest things for those of us who are raised on instant gratification, or maybe infant gratification. But the idea that I think Larry Keene, in talking to Larry Keene, who's, of course, NSSF general counsel, mm-hmm. said that we sort of created a whole new industry for attorneys.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's good for you, David. Good for you.
Yeah, yeah. It'll keep me busy for the next 10 years.
Another just a question. This is something I talked to Larry Keene about, and it's in the wording, in Scalia's wording, when he talked about dangerous and unusual, did he, in effect, now create a test for which firearm was not covered under the Second Amendment?
I think he contrasts dangerous and unusual with arms in common use at the time. The test seems to be that if an arm is in common use, that is protected. If it's not only dangerous but unusual in some way, then it's not. Of course, there's some ambiguity there. I would prefer to read dangerous and unusual to mean a hand grenade. No doubt there are some people who go out there, well, a semi-automatic rifle, but it's hard to say a rifle is unusual, certainly. I think he's putting that in just as reassurance. He may have had, he's got to keep a five-vote majority together. And someone may have gotten a little worried about, well, what about artillery pieces? Aren't they arms? And so, you know, that I think he had to put that in.
So another question that comes out of that is, where do we go from here? And you've been very much an activist in Second Amendment issues for a long time. So you must be thinking, okay, what we have a victory. Now, what are the next steps that we need to take to assure the long-term victory?
Well, let's see. On the legal end, the challenge to the Chicago law, getting it applied to the states, I'd say followed by a challenge to the most restrictive jurisdictions in New York, getting it established that a an arbitrary and permit-based restriction of the right is also unconstitutional. Where you go from there, I don't know. Politically, I can tell you one thing for certain. We better be out and voting in this next presidential race. Justice Stevens, who wrote the dissent, the main dissent, is, I believe, what, 85 or 86?
Yep.
Justice
Something in
Ginsburg
there
is around 80. So, essentially, the, our side of the thing is young by Supreme Court standards, mere 60s.
Pups.
The other side is up there. If we get a guy in who will make just one pro-Second Amendment appointment, we'll shift it to a 6-3. Two would give us 7-2. So, I rather doubt that President Obama would do that sort of thing, so we'll have to be out there voting.
President Obama, I believe, would probably put Edward Kennedy there.
Kennedy's probably a little right for him, He'd prefer someone really left.
Well, David, thank you very much for taking the time. I appreciate you taking the time here. Sure. And I know you've been a very busy man for the last day. You've been kind of all over the place. I will mention again, as I mentioned in my opening, that you're the creator of In Search of the Second Amendment documentary, that anybody who wants a more in-depth view of the Second Amendment, an understanding of what we won yesterday, they could do a lot worse than getting a hold of this documentary and watching it and studying it. So thank you again, and congratulations, because I know you had a lot to do with this victory.
Yeah, thank you.
Have you noticed that one of the things everybody keeps coming back to is the November presidential election? The general thinking on the internet, the quick analysis sort of thinking on the internet, the flash analysis of this decision, is that it was a very good decision for Barack Obama. Because as one blog put it, it takes guns off the table in the election. I think Glenn Harlan Reynolds, who of course is the founder and producer of Instapundit, one of the most popular blogs on the internet, and is a law professor in Tennessee, was a little more gentle, but said similarly, same thing in Reason Online. He said that basically this isn't a decision that really fires up the troops and guarantees that they're going to rush right out and pull the lever for John McCain. So in that sense, it's good for Obama. But I think the thing we need to keep in mind is this is a 5-4 decision. My friends at Say Uncle, another really very super popular gun blog, the way they said it was, we were one heart attack away from losing the Second Amendment. And you heard David Hardy reference it here. If we have a president who's able to get another Second Amendment person, another Second Amendment advocate on the court, then we're 6-3, or maybe two more, maybe we're 7-2. It's a way to protect our rights. So what this election in 2008 is shaping up on is certainly the most anti-gun candidate in history ever, Barack Obama, versus John McCain, who occasionally has not been a friend for us. But I hope has seen the light. We'll be talking a little bit more about that later on, a couple of weeks. But it's a critical election because of the judges, and I think we can all see that now. 5-4, a 5-4 decision, one heart attack away from losing the Second Amendment. So thank you, David Hardy, and again, I cannot recommend the Second Amendment, In Search of the Second Amendment documentary enough. It's a fine documentary. Go to Downrange Television, www.downrange.tv, and of course we will tell you where to go to be able to purchase that documentary. So, thanks for joining us. We have more reports coming up throughout the day. I'm your host, Michael Bain. This is Downrange Radio, the voice of the gun culture.